It's a real pleasure to have a chance to talk with Jean-Yves Thibaudet, a pianist that we've admired for so many years, and I'd have to say, to be honest, even been astonished by his playing and his advocacy for music of so many different styles and eras. And for whatever reason, just over the years, and he's been a regular guest at Orchestra Hall, both with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and in recital, we just have not had a chance to talk with him. So this is a chance to catch up a bit and also talk about what he's in town to do. When we had this conversation, he was in rehearsals with Bernard Haitink and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra for performances, four of them, in fact, of Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand alone. And he also has a very busy and truly international, intercontinental yes. schedule. You're just in from Australia?
Yes, I was in September was an interesting month. I went to Hong Kong, just back and forth to open the season with the orchestra. Then I was back in Europe. Then I went to Australia for about 10 days. And then I went back to Europe and then to the States immediately. And this is all in the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
I don't know how
it's not every month
anyone,
like that, thank God.
I don't know how anyone does that. And then you've also been doing this both in recital and with an amazing variety of orchestras as well.
And also an amazing variety of repertoire, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, all different orchestras is great, but if it could be once in a while the same piece, it would help too. It is once in a while. I'm exaggerating. But it's just true that often I just end up having... It's a very difficult battle to to win because I personally don't like to play one or two pieces all year round. I just like to play different repertoire. So I offer four or five, at least, minimum concertos to different orchestras. But of course, if
you mean in a season, obviously
in
you know
season.
Many more than that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Right. We played over 50 different concertos.
Right.
But in a season, let's say I will come up with four or five that we want to push for that season. We'll offer them to the orchestras. And then if in a month I have four orchestras, chances are that each one is going to choose a different one.
Right.
You can never get two of the same in a row. It's so fascinating.
And you're also touring with Helsinki.
I'm touring with a few orchestras. The Australia tour was actually with the LPO. The London Philharmonic and Vladimir Yurovsky. Now, the tour in Europe, it's a small tour with the Helsinki Philharmonic and the Halle Orchestra. This is a long story. It actually was a beautiful and big, important European tour with the Baltimore Symphony and Marion Alsop. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, with all the financial problems
right.
that the orchestras have in this country and everywhere, we had to postpone, I like to say, that tour. Hopefully, we'll come back one day. But in the meantime, we had all this chunk of time hold, and also the holes had... The concert, I mean, it was all planned.
Right.
So what they've done, they try to save it with different orchestras.
Okay.
So we have a few concerts with the Helsinki, a few concerts with Halle, and it's only like half of the tour, but at least we saved a few dates.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing that even with the economy as it's been, and as we hope it won't be forever, there still, though, is this tremendous desire and tremendous demand all around the world for...
Yes. I think probably even more in a way. I mean, the money problem is something for the organizations, also for the people. Maybe they have less money to spend. But I think that music in general, in difficult time, I think music is even more important because it always is important. But I think people use it and need it even more maybe when they're in difficult time because it's really something that soothes you, calms you. It's music is so therapeutic, really. It really is.
You started playing at a very early age. Was there music already in your family?
My father was playing violin. He was not a professional violinist, but he was playing rather well. And my mother, I heard, play the piano. I've never seen her do it, but she said she did. I'm sure she did, like all the good girls from the good families. But she was not a pianist either. So music was in the family in that sense, was very present. They were going to concerts, took me at a very early age to concerts. We had records at home. I was listening to record, always classical, though. And we had a piano at home, which probably was also part of the deal in my choice, maybe. So, but all that being said, I'm the first professional musician in the family on both sides that we know of.
And how was it that you came, coming from a family of, in the best sense, and in the French language sense, amateurs, how was it that you came to work with such extraordinary teachers, at least in terms of their history?
I was very lucky. You know, I think it's pure luck. I came at the right time with the right people. All my teachers were wonderful at every level of my life. From the first one, who was absolutely unknown, but was a marvelous lady who actually put my hands on the piano. That is probably one of the most important moments. Her name was Geneviève Coin. wonderful teacher. I just adored her. I just always liked my teacher. They were, and I think that's very important. I had a great affection for them. They were wonderful to me, very generous with their time, with their patience, with their enthusiasm. And each one at every point was important. Then I cannot name them all, but it's one of them in Paris, in Lyon, where I was born, where I started to study, called Suzy Bossard, who recommended me to Lucette Descaves, that fantastic teacher in Paris. They were very close, and she was used to send her students to her when they were going to Paris. And she sent me when I was 11 years old. She told me you should start going once a month to Paris and have a lesson with Madame Descaves, and then eventually get into her class in the conservatory. And that's exactly what I did.
We should explain for the listeners who don't know, but here was Jean-Yves Thibaudet at 11 going to see Lucette Descaves. And when she was about that age, she was seeing a gentleman named Ravel.
That's perfectly, absolutely right. Yeah, Lucette Descaves was, and much later as well, because yes, she was a very old lady already. Actually, right, I was officially in her class at the conservatory only 1 year because she retired. Yeah. And she already had been pushed, I don't know, 5-10 years from the actual normal age of retirement. She was really, and then she lived well into her 90s, and I was very close to her until the end of her life. But this lady, as you said, was a close friend and collaborator of Ravel, played for him, played with him the concerto. She was also Marguerite Long's assistant, who was the dedicatee of the concerto in G. So she lives through that incredible period in Paris.
And she was a good teacher, too.
And she was a fantastic teacher.
One doesn't necessarily make for the other. No. She might have just had great anecdotes to tell.
That's true, you're absolutely right. And she certainly did have a lot of those. But no, in her case, actually her career was not as long as it should have been, because she started having, at an early age, rheumatism in her hands that were deforming, something really horrible for a pianist. Mm-hmm. So she became forced to become a pedagogue and a teacher, and she became one of the greatest, really, teachers in Paris. A great class at the conservatory for many, many years with great students, and she had that incredible history with all those French, of course, composers of that time. But also, for example, to name another one, Prokofiev, because Prokofiev lived a big part of at that point in his life in Paris,
right,
and she was very close to him. She would see him all the time. They would have dinner. So she had all those fantastic stories and scores to show you with annotation, remarks, sometimes mistakes corrected by the composer. Mm-hmm. And that was really priceless.
I'm curious to know, in some recent books and articles that have come out, as people have done more research on the Wittgenstein family, you get the sense that on the one hand, Paul Wittgenstein was commissioning all of these left-hand concertos. On the other hand, it seems like he didn't always like the people he commissioned them from, and he didn't always like the pieces. And some of them, of course, have only been played now, like Fleischer's playing the Hindemith concerto. I'm curious if you recall from Madame Descaves or anybody else anything about Ravel and Prokofiev and Wittgenstein.
I only know about the Ravel. You're right. Prokofiev we never spoke about, because I never played that concerto. Mm-hmm. I only studied the third with Madame Descaves. But on the Wittgenstein, definitely. I mean, I think Wittgenstein obviously had a great admiration for Ravel. And Ravel was, a very important and great composer. So I think he was right, of course, obviously, to commission him. I think, on the other hand, he hated the piece that Ravel delivered to him. And that's his choice. I mean, everything's personal. But he was very unhappy with the piece. I think for a lot of reasons. One of them probably because it's terribly difficult, and probably was not happy that he would have to practice so much.
Right.
And then also he was unhappy because he thought it was too much solo piano and tutti. When you look at the score, there's only really quite a few minutes where the orchestra and the piano are playing together. A lot of it is big tutti's, then big cadenzas, then again a tutti, another cadenza, then eventually a little bit together. And this is because Ravel knew that he could, if he wanted to have the full orchestra playing as loud as they want and with all the beautiful color that he wanted, the piano with one hand would not be heard. So he had to really find a way to go around it.
Right.
But the other one was not happy. Wittgenstein said, I commissioned you for a concerto. So why do you give me all those cadenzas and all those tutti's? And then they had fights about he wanted to change things. And Ravel said, you don't touch a note of that piece or I take it back from you.
Right.
And it was quite nasty, I think. He really didn't want him to play it. And then at the end, I think they made friends again, and it happened. But it was not a very pretty and happy collaboration, that's for sure, from what I heard.
How is the collaboration between Ravel, the eternal composer, and Thibaudet, the pianist? Where's the piece for you?
It's, I have a very strange story with this left-hand concerto, because I think by age 15, I probably had performed and learned all the Ravel solo music and the Ravel G major concerto, which I played when I was 11. It was my first concerto ever. So all of that I knew by age 15. And then it's only probably maybe 20 years later or close to that that I learned the left hand. I resisted a long time for a few reasons. One of them, I think probably the main reason, was that I looked at the score and I thought it was horribly difficult with one hand. And I said, I'm blessed to have two hands working. Why should I bother learning that piece? So I found all kind of excuses saying I didn't like the piece. But you know what? I didn't really know it, I think. I kind of was kind of going around it. I just didn't want to learn it. And then it happened that a marvelous guy called John Drummond, who was the director of the Proms in London for many, many years, was inviting me very generously every year to play there, which was fantastic. And one year he told me, well, okay, next year, after, you know, we had dinner after one of the performances, he said, next year you come and you do the Ravel left hand. Oh, I said, John, I don't play that piece. Well, I said, you learn it. I said, I don't want to learn it. He said, you learn it, or you don't come and play here.
Oh.
He was very tough. I said, okay, John. So I thought about it. I said, you know, maybe I'll learn it.
But and this was based on his knowing you and knowing the piece, and that this was someone you didn't just want a job from. You could trust that maybe it's worth thinking about this.
I don't know. I was still, I thought he was just being difficult, and I still didn't really want to learn it. But I love the Proms. And no, I think at the end of the day, I realized that it was probably time that I mean, Madame Descaves and all my teacher, Ciccolini, also always told me you should really learn that concerto. It's a great concerto. And I was just resisting, but I did. It was difficult. It was difficult to learn. It was difficult also physically to play. I mean, it was a completely new experience for me. But
that
I'm
was
so
the first one-hand major
Absolutely.
Work that you were
oh,
playing.
Oh, actually, probably the first one-hand work ever.
Period. Yeah.
Period. Yeah, I don't think.
What
I
is that like? I mean, are you?
It's a very strange feeling because you feel that you have to shift the balance of your body completely
right.
on the left side, and actually it does it by itself. It's like all the adrenaline and all the rush goes to the left side of your body. And it's very bizarre. For example, when I finish playing that concerto or practicing it a while, my right hand is completely numb. Kind of, I couldn't play immediately something difficult with the right hand, which is very bizarre because even if I don't play for 2 days, I can still play immediately something with the right hand. But that's just been because you have this rush that goes to the left and you just completely forget. So that's one of the things. Also, you have to build, I would say, muscular, almost an athletic left hand and left arm, because it's not normal to play with that strength only on one hand and one
right.
arm for even if it's only 20 minutes. But practicing, we mean 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours of practice, you can just kill yourself for that. You can kill your muscles. So you have to go very slowly. And I remember when I started learning the piece, I would go about half an hour and then I would stop because my hand would hurt. Then I would do something else. Then I'd come back. The next day I would do 45 minutes and kind of build your strength. And still now, it's very funny. It's a piece that I play on and off often, then I don't play it for a while, but it's present in my repertoire. And if I don't play it for, let's say, a year or a few months, when it comes back for a performance, I still need, I would say, about a week to be safe to bring it back, not just because of the notes, but just physically again. I need to bring back that stamina and that physical strength in my left arm without hurting my muscles and my tendons and everything that's in the hand. And most concertos, I can look at them the day before the first rehearsal, they'll come right back and it's fine. But this one is beyond that. You just have to build that athletic, almost, you know, part of it.
I imagine, too, there, at least initially when you're working with it or bringing it back in, there must be some psychological points where you're thinking, just as you would any time you're working out fingering, you're thinking at a certain point, oh, well, I can just hit that with the right second finger.
It's funny. I never thought of it. I know people
really?
Always think it seems so logical.
It shuts off.
It completely does. I mean, because the point of that piece is that it's written for the left hand. I mean, I've never, ever even thought about it. And because I knew I wouldn't do it anyway.
I didn't poison your mind now.
No, because people tell me all the time. But at the end of the day, I don't think it would. It might make it easier, for sure it would, but it would change completely the way it would sound, because this is what makes it, that awkwardness, kind of, you know, the way it's written, that gives it what it is. And it would sound, if you were playing with two hands, it would sound like a different piece. I'm absolutely sure.
Thank you.
We're talking with Jean-Yves Thibaudet, pianist, born and raised and studied in France, long resident in Los Angeles in this country, as well as still, of course, in Paris. And we are sort of initially using teachers as a way of talking about a wide range of things with this artist whose mind and history ranges widely over so much repertoire and so many other topics and insights. You just alluded to Ciccolini, and obviously this is someone who just the name, it just resonates for people, even people who never heard him play. And of course, later in life, he played less and less, particularly in the U.S. What was he like as a teacher? And
Fantastic teacher, a great pedagogue. And as you said earlier, it's not the case. It's not because you're a great pianist or a great anything that you're a great teacher. This is a completely different gift that people have or don't have. I think you can improve and all of that, but Aldo was born an incredible teacher, and there's no question about that. And he loves teaching. He really enjoys it. He is now, let me see, he's 84 years old. He's doing great, playing like a god, probably playing better than ever. Really? I'm really sorry that he doesn't travel to the States, and he hasn't, because he is one of the most important, incredible, really, artists of our time. And it's a shame that he wasn't able to perform more in this country and in some other places. But he is doing so incredibly well right now. He plays, I think it has to do with age, with a lot of different things that happen in his life. But it becomes like, I always like to say, it becomes like, you know, you have the cologne, then you have the eau de parfum, then you have the perfume. And this is like the perfume. This is like the essence. It's all distilled to, and he plays now Schubert sonatas like no one else. It's just unbelievable.
Where is he playing?
He plays a lot in Europe, of course, I mean, in France, in Italy, in Germany, I mean, all over Europe. He actually does travel. He's amazing. He still takes, he teaches a lot. And also he takes the plane to go to teach in Italy almost like every month, at least once. And he's been to Asia a few times. He'd love to go to Japan. There's something about the States with him. Yeah. I don't know that he just never really
was. Going to have to figure out a way to
exactly. But anyway, he was a phenomenal teacher. And his I always say that lessons with him were not piano lessons. They were lessons of life. Mm-hmm. Because the guy also has an incredible culture, like to a degree that is like people just don't do anymore nowadays. Mm-hmm. He just knows everything about everything. He's read in seven languages. He speaks seven languages. It's just so amazing. You can speak with him about anything in life. And so the lessons, we would be at the piano, of course. Then we would have lunch. I would go to his home like at 9:30 in the morning.
Which was where?
In Agnières, outside of Paris. He had his little pavillon, we call it, like a townhouse. And that's where he lived all the life that I knew him.
Right.
And I would go there in the morning and we would spend the day. Then we'd work, then we'd speak, then we'd have lunch, then we'd work again, speaking. He would show me a book, then tell me about something, play for me, then I'd play for it. It was unbelievable. Then we'd speak again sometime until late in the evening. Sometimes we'd even stay overnight because it was too late for me to take my train back to, little train back to Paris. I mean, those were the kind of time we had together. And it was an amazing, amazing teacher, really.
Were there some things about Ravel, coming back to Ravel for a moment, that you gained from him either as a pianist or a teacher?
Yes, absolutely. I have to say that he, being Italian, he was Italian from Naples, from a fantastic school of piano, which goes somehow meets with the Argentinian school, Scaramuzza, because his teacher in Vincenzo Vitale in Naples was a student of Scaramuzza. So it was all that things together. It was amazing history there. But this being said, Aldo came to Paris when he was very young, when he was 19, I believe, when he won the Marguerite Long competition, and Marguerite Long was still alive, and he was very close to her. So he started that French connection, which is the same than me, in a way, with Lucette Descaves. He had it directly with Marguerite Long, and he played a lot of this music, of course, as well. So it was very interesting what I learned from him. What I would say what I learned from him, I met him already when I was probably 15 or 16. So all this year with Lucette Descaves already behind me, and all those years of Ravel, you know, of course, and all of that. I think what Aldo brought me then was most pianistically, I would say, in a way, mechanically. Not, I mean, also, of course, interpretation, some fantastic thing that he had. But I would say a lot technical, like about the way to do things, trills, octaves, a lot of things. Just he had this, and he still has this amazing, beautiful technique. And he really, I still learned so much from him at that moment. And then, of course, still also the interpretation. I remember, you know what I would say also, pedaling. Pedaling with him, he opened an entire new door, a new way to look at the piano playing for me with the pedals. Because pedals were there before in my life, obviously. I was using them just because they were there and because I needed them. But I wasn't really thinking so much about pedaling. And it became with him like a different instrument. Suddenly, pedaling were a part of playing. It was part of, it was a gymnastic. You really had to learn how to pedal with your feet and use the three pedal, the sostenuto, the middle one as well. And I learned a lot about that as well with him, which was
interesting. Was it with a particular piece or composer that he started bringing that more to your attention?
Yes, I would say probably, maybe, Ravel. I'm thinking of Gaspard de la Nuit, for example, mm-hmm. and Scarbot and a lot of other things. Obviously, a lot of 20th century music. Because, mm-hmm. But this being said, once you start with this, you right. realize that, and he was doing it, certainly, in Bach. I mean, there's a lot of places where it comes so handy. So people are going to tell you, of course, that in Beethoven or Chopin's time, it was not available, and he would, fine, but it doesn't mean you cannot use it. I still think that in a lot of cases, it makes the music better because it gives you a possibility technically that you would not be able to do it otherwise.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, especially in Ravel's music, as you know, he wrote very often his music first for the piano and then he orchestrated it. But in his mind was already all the orchestration.
Right.
And there's so many moments in his music where you think of, say, like a holding a chord or holding an octave or something, and then other things would be played by other instruments. And in the piano, with just a normal pedal, you just hold everything or nothing. And with this middle pedal, you can hold just one thing, and then the rest cannot not be in the pedal. It's fascinating what you can do. And people, and for some reason, that was never really such an importance in my piano playing. And that's really Aldo who really put his finger on that and really said, listen, you can do a lot with pedaling. It's going to change your life. And it really did.
I can both hear, and fortunately, I can also see as you're talking about this, Jean-Yves, that this is something that still is rolling in your mind. And that's one of the things I think that's always so exciting about going to hear you perform, is that one knows that this is an artist who's, the doors are not closed at all. You're always looking and thinking about new things, even with existing repertoire that you have.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, as I said, the G major concerto is the first concerto I played when I was 11. God knows how many times I've played in my life. It's still, first of all, I still practice when I play it.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is fresh as it was composed or learned yesterday for me. And I still enjoy every single time that I perform it, practice it, or whatever it is, hear it. It's just one of those magical pieces. And I still find new things in there. And I thought I knew everything about this piece backwards. And I still look at the score and some still will find a little something or something in the orchestra that makes me think of maybe I can do that differently. And also learn from playing it with different conductors. Sometimes a conductor will tell me one thing or say, why do you do this? Why wouldn't do you? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So it's a constant, constant lesson. And that's, I think, what makes music and arts in general, performing arts, makes it so wonderful and so exciting that you have never reached a point where things stop. It's like there's no limit. We can always do, it's not just better, but better, different, try to go closer to perfection, which of course we'll never attain. But all of that is incredibly exciting. I think without that, it would be very boring. If we knew that, okay, now I play this is the best, I'm going to play this piece, I'm going to sit on it now for the rest of my life, it'd be terrible. So we know we can do better and we can practice more and find something else. And I really, really do. I remember years ago, when I did all the Rachmaninoff concertos with Ashkenazi in Cleveland and we recorded them, it was, of course, a phenomenal experience. Mm-hmm. And I was very humble and at the beginning very nervous to play with Ashkenazi conducting those Rachmaninoff concertos. And and I was really thinking, God, if this guy, he's got to help me, he's got to teach me things, he can teach me so much. And he was so, being himself, an incredibly modest and person there, not shy, but you know, he would never impose, never say. And I had really to go to him and I said, Vova, please, hear what, you know, those kind of things. And then he would help me and tell me. And then, boy, did he tell me some fantastic things. But I remember one thing, that's why I'm saying, telling the story.
Sure.
Is that it was a passage in the third concerto, Rachmaninoff third, which is incredibly difficult. It's just so hard. It was one passage where I said, what are you doing? I said, this is horrible. This is so difficult. Oh, he said, let me tell you, it's been difficult all my life. He said, it still is difficult. But he's told me that he had found, after, I don't know, 40, 50 years, he had actually found a fingering that was better, that he's been looking all his life.
Oh.
And he very generously gave it to me and showed me. I mean, fingering is very personal. It could have been bad for me. It just happened that it was
It's
really
like a chef will let you watch certain things in the kitchen, but when it comes to the little spice packet, that's something he's developed.
That's right. And that was a fantastic fingering. It just happened to also work for me. But just to say that it took him all those years that he played. And then suddenly one day he said, oh, my God, this, of course, this is it. And this happened. And when that happens, it's just really exciting. You're like a little you know, kid that had found a new toy or something. Yeah,
I see that from your response. That certainly somebody else who thought this way about writing music, making music, bringing music to others, and about life in general as being just a constant adventure and search was Bernstein. And you're going to be playing Bernstein in several cities this coming season.
I am, and it's a piece that I love, The Age of Anxiety. It's one of his great pieces, really. I don't know if it's very extremely popular like some other piece, but those people who don't know that piece should really look into it because it's a phenomenal poem by William Auden. And then Bernstein
wrote W.H. Auden.
Yeah. W.H. Auden, yeah. And Bernstein wrote that symphony. I think it's called Symphony. Right? It's the Symphony Number 2, The Age of Anxiety. But the piano has more than prominent part. I mean, it's almost like a concerto. Its piano is in the orchestra, but almost like a concerto. It's a very important piano part. And I think it's a fascinating piece. And Bernstein, I always say that there's two people, I mean, there's, of course, a lot of people that I would have loved to meet in my life. But there's two, especially, that I could have, years-wise, met and played with. And it's Bernstein and Karajan. Those two... Yeah. Great man, I would have loved to.
And very different from each
God,
other.
Oh, yes. And they didn't like each other.
I was
at
about
all.
To say, you wouldn't have been able to have had one lunch, you
That's
know?
Right. But I know, I really would. And Bernstein probably must have been an incredible, incredible character.
Charming. I mean, man, and with an intelligence, I can imagine
knowledge
what you're
again.
Thinking. Yeah, because there's so much that the two of you could have connected on and worked on and thought about and laughed about and drank about. And
yes,
you know.
I think he really just loved life.
Yeah.
And what it's, and enjoyed his life. And I think that's the greatest golden rule. You have to enjoy your life. We're here on the earth to enjoy our life. So let's have a good time. And I think that really, I know a lot of people who knew him very well. So I've heard a lot of things.
Badly, how did the piece come to you, Age of Anxiety?
It's Michael Tilson Thomas, MTT, a few years ago, or actually now it's probably 10 or 15 years ago, one day just told me about the piece that I didn't know, I have to confess. And he said, I'd like to perform it with you. Why don't you learn the piece? And I said, okay, I'll learn it. And I learned it with him.
So I would say you had the Lucette de Cave of Bernstein here.
I remember I went to New World Symphony in Florida, and we spent a week, and I remember being in his studio and just kind of almost, I would say, side reading with Michael next to me and telling me what to do, what not to do, telling me about the piece, the story, telling me funny story that Bernstein was just making me laugh. It was fantastic. So that will remain forever, really. It's really with him. He really feed me like with a spoon, The Age of Anxiety. And then since then, I've done it with other people, of course, but that's how I learned it.
Now, I imagine you were too young to have met Duke Ellington, but did you ever meet Bill Evans?
No, I could also have.
Yes.
I didn't. I discovered jazz quite late. I mean, late. I would just mean compared to the rest of music that came so early in my life. I think I was probably my 15, 16 years old.
When you're playing 10 years, that's late, you know?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Just because it wasn't present at home at all. My parents were really... classical music oriented. The only thing else we would have at home was pop because my sister was a little bit older than me and she would listen, of course, to all those pop idol from those days. So this we would listen, but no jazz, really. That's I discovered being alone at the conservatory, actually with a radio station. I had my first little studio, very small little place where I was at the conservatory, and I would play the radio station and I started listening to this jazz music. And then I started going out to jazz clubs in Paris and it again opened a new window in my musical life, and I immediately was fascinated and fell in love with that music, and decided that I had to know more about it, listen to more about it, and maybe one day do a little bit of myself.
And what was it about Bill Evans's music?
Well, Bill Evans came even later after that. I after all those years of jazz, it's not until I would say the late 80s, I mean, he already passed away, that I suddenly learned about Bill Evans. For some reason, I don't know, I hadn't just not heard or not realized who he was. But when I did, it became like a new idol and a new really highlight, very important person in my musical life. And I started listening to his recording and like having an indigestion, so then listening to boxes and boxes and boxes, everything I could find. And I became completely fascinated and realized that this guy was one of the greatest pianists, and not only jazz pianist, just pianist in general. Composer also, and that he had his own school, like his own world. It was like Debussy, you would say, or Bill Evans. You recognize immediately, it was like, this is Bill Evans. And his touch, beautiful. So I started looking into it, asking friends. I have some wonderful friend that helped me with that, looking into a lot of possibilities, what I could do with it. And then I realized that not only he was classically trained, and actually met once in Louisiana, one of his first teachers. So he was taught, of course, piano, flute, conducting, all of that as a classical musician. So he had maybe a different brain somehow than some other of those jazz musicians, which makes him, what for me was the real key, is that I find his music extremely close to Debussy, more mm-hmm. Debussy than Ravel, but I would say, mm-hmm. let's say, to the Impressionists, to the turn of the century French musical composers. I find him so close to that. Mm-hmm. And the way he was playing himself, performing, also, it's very different than a lot of other jazz pianists.
Yes.
An incredible variety of colors, of dynamics, of beauty of the sound, not that kind of percussive, right. He had that as well sometimes, sure. But it was just incredible. And I felt that all of that were things that were very close to my world, and I felt very attracted and very close to him, and I wanted to go to that world and started playing some of his pieces, and I felt incredibly comfortable, which I would have not with some other great jazz composer, just because they were really too jazzy, you know.
Right.
Yet.
Right.
I had to learn yet about a lot of things. I still have to, but so anyway, that's how my first experience with jazz as a performer, Kim, is performing Bill Evans's music, and I felt really comfortable with it, and that was for me a start. That was my start.
Another parallel that I would sense as a listener is with Debussy and Evans, even though they are writing things and they are making compositions, there's a sense of them thinking at the piano, creating at the piano, and then finding something and then continuing it. But this ability to give even a written piece an improvisatory character in the composition mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah, if you think about it, it goes much further. I always like to say that, for example, Chopin was completely improvising. When
right.
he was performing, he right. was improvising. And I think when you play Chopin, it should sound like you sit at the piano and you improvise. Mm-hmm. It should be completely free and fresh. And this, and Liszt also was improvising. I think those guys,
of course,
at
yeah.
some point, had to write down something on a piece
that's
of paper
right.
just because they have to earn their life. And these are where they're making money with the publishing and all of that. But I'm sure they were playing differently every time. And I'm sure they wouldn't bother. I mean, they wouldn't mind if you were telling them, oh, here, I'd like to add an octave or do this or do that. I'm sure Liszt never played twice the same piece. And now, I mean, just notes.
Sure.
I'm sure he was changing, flourishing,
sure.
doing things all the time. Yeah. And I think we kind of lost that. Even Mozart. I mean, when he thinks of Mozart right. concertos.
He hated to have to go and then write it all down.
And
he wanted to go
to
the next one.
Exactly. And why do we have so few cadenzas? Because
yeah.
Mozart was improvising.
Right.
And in those days, musicians would improvise at the time of the cadenza. They would just, the orchestra would stop and they would just start and improvise for a few minutes.
What
Who
you
can do,
do for
that now?
What do you do for cadenzas in Mozart and Beethoven?
Actually, I've written the little of the Mozart concerto that I play. It's only three or four.
Mm-hmm.
And those that didn't have any cadenza, I actually wrote my own cadenzas,
mm-hmm.
which are, but they're in the Mozart, I mean,
right.
they're not jazz, you know,
right.
not like Felix Gulda or,
yeah.
I wish I heard him, it was fantastic, but I don't have that possibility, but no, I had fun, a good time doing
that. And how about Beethoven?
Beethoven, I wrote a cadenza for the second concerto.
Yeah.
I feel very, you know, I know some people say, well, why didn't you play the cadenza? Of course, the cadenza that he wrote is a phenomenal piece of music. It just happened that it's so far, so many years apart from the concerto, that to me it has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's a phenomenal piece, and of course it fits great in the concerto, no problem. But I just felt like, I was, I guess, a very pretentious little boy when I did it, because it was a long time ago, but I felt like writing cadenza for that concerto that was in the spirit of that.
Yeah, a Beethovenian
exactly,
cadenza kind of from
in
that
the,
time.
In the Mozart, exactly. And this is what I did.
It's an early piece.
And I actually usually still, I have to say still, when I perform the concerto, I usually perform my cadenza.
the Thibaudet edition.
That's right. Thank you.
More than 40 records on Decca, more than 50 concertos already in your repertoire. What's coming, though, because you are always looking for new things? Are you working on some new repertoire now?
Oh, definitely. I mean, not only I'm working on your repertoire.
What are you working on? I know you are working on something.
And I'm also working on new commissions. I've done quite a few commissions lately in my life, and I think it's very exciting and wonderful when you find a composer that you like, you admire, you want to champion and just have him write or her write a piece for you, then I really like to do it. Just to mention the latest one I've done, one is Behzad Ranjbaran, a marvelous composer who lives in New York now, but from Persian heritage, wrote a beautiful concerto for me that we premiered with the Atlanta Symphony and Robert Spano about 2 years ago. It's a big epic concerto, like a big romantic concerto, 35 minutes, a lot of cadenzas and really wonderful piece. Then a short piece, the piano and orchestra again, Guillaume Connaisson, a French composer, that really has that talent for me, that he really comes with that tradition of French composers behind, a thing of colors and atmosphere that he brings to the orchestra. And this is about 10 minutes. It's a short piece in one movement. It's called The Shining One, Lettre de Lumière. And then the next one to come that I haven't performed yet, but it's very exciting. James Macmillan just wrote a concerto for me, and it will be premiered in 10-11 with the Minnesota Orchestra and Osmovanska. So that's my next big concerto that I have to learn. But those pieces are, and I've done many others before, those are really exciting. It's a different experience, obviously.
Sure.
But what I like about it especially is when the composer really became a friend and became close to me and knew how to, because I feel they're written for me. It's like when they really listen to you so many times, and when they write it, they think about you. I think about your abilities, not only technical, but what your forties are, what you can do better than others, whatever. They really do that thinking about you, and I think that's so special, you know. Yeah, I like that element that it makes it so personal. Right. How fantastic is that?
They understand you, and you have a sense of their music, and in a way, the work, it's not created from scratch together, but there's a sense of reaching towards each other to make something.
And they think about you when they write it. And also there's a lot of them, I think most of them are being very flexible, not like Ravel with Wittgenstein. I remember telling both Behzad and Guillaume a few things. I mean, technically, I said, listen, this is a bit awkward. Can we change it for this? I always said, fine, if that's better for you. And they ask you, they want you to be involved. And that makes it, of course, very unique.
Any new works for your recital programs? Because you're obviously also very active as a recitalist.
Yes, recital. I always have to. I'm very happy to go regularly to a lot of places, but it makes also the life difficult because it's a place I've played everything I know, so I need to learn something. You know, I need to learn something else.
Yeah.
Which I do with pleasure. Yeah. It just takes time. So it really, really depends. Right now, I'm concentrating. In 2011 will be the Liszt anniversary, and Liszt is one of my great favorite composers as well. I always love to play his music. So that's going to be a very special year for me. And I want to put together...
Let's hope Maestro Muti is listening to this interview because it's a favorite of his as well.
Oh, is it? Well, fantastic. Yeah. You know, he should really, I'm sure. It's a great... I think this is a great composer that is underappreciated and I think underestimated. People don't realize how great a composer and how important he was in his time.
And so, how varied his compositions can be.
Well, like his life. He had an amazing life. Right. Going through everything you can imagine, ending at the end of his life, became religious, became an abbey. It was just unbelievable. But anyway, I'm looking for some very special recital program, avoiding all the sonatas. Right. I mean, that whatever everybody's going to play, which are fantastic. But I think we also have to put a light on some of his obscure pieces that really are obscure in every sense. They're very dark, like the late stage piece that he wrote for the piano are. Miracle. They're so modern, you would think they're like already Schoenberg or something. Right. It's unbelievable. So I'm putting together a recital program that, of course, will have some easier and popular stuff and all of that, but also a lot of pieces that
it will be an all list program?
It will be, yes. It will be an all list recital. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I really want to offer
for 2011.
Yeah, 11. I'll do it 10, 11, 11, 12, because we go, our seasons go, you know.
Right.
So I'll offer it for a little bit more.
Great.
But that's right now a little bit of my. And there also will be a lot of. Paraphrases and transcriptions. Mm-hmm. He himself did so many, not only operas, but also from like Symphonie Fantastique, just anything
Wagner.
He transcribed from the piano and with such genius. Yeah. So you have to pick there a little bit in there. So it'll be interesting.
You have your own opera transcription.
Yes. Well, that was a in those days in the 19th century. Every pianist was making his own transcriptions of anything, an opera, and they would sit down and just play and improvise and do things. And then it kind of completely got lost in the time. So when I did two albums. One of them is only Liszt, all my favorite Liszt opera transcriptions, and then the last one I did, the aria, opera without words, is a lot of different people, including I thought I had to do at least two or three myself, just to show that. That was still, you know, it was the point of doing the record.
When you do your own paraphrases, whether it's of an opera or jazz or anything, do you do them, we were talking about with Mozart and the others, but do you do them first at the keyboard and then notate them? Do you have somebody else do the scoring? Do you write them and then play
really
them?
It depends. In that particular project, the aria recording for Decca, I have to say that I really did get some help. It was a matter of time also, just the essence. I was just so busy that I wanted to do this, and I just didn't have enough time. Or I would have needed to take like 2 or a month or 6 months of sabbatical, just stop and just doing this, and I just really couldn't do that. So I had some fantastic help. And this is, but still, it was done together. It's like we would sit down, and I would say, this is what I would like. We all had different ideas. I would say, this is my ideas. How can we make that work? And then I would kind of play it at the piano, and then we'd meet again the week after. They would show me things. And so it was really done with me, even if I didn't write myself every single note, which takes a hell of a lot of time, you know, to write. Right. Especially there's a lot of notes in those transcriptions. So I think the idea had to come from me. And then eventually, you know, I got help. Yeah, it's true.
You are very busy, even compared to many of your contemporaries in terms of your touring, your recording, your repertoire, your range. But you must also, at least informally, have, if not time for, make some opportunities to mentor or at least connect with other pianists, younger pianists who want to know from your experience, because you also probably would be a natural teacher. I hope you don't have to become one for reasons that some of your teachers did, but do you ever think about that side of things?
I do think about it, and it's a side that I've discovered over the time. Obviously, I didn't teach until, you know, I mean, when I was really young, I didn't do it. Then it started a little bit, I remember, I think in Japan, probably they asked me for the first time, but this is years ago. And then still now, it's a matter of time, as you said. I just don't have enough time for it. But I do master classes. I do it quite regularly. In some places, I go once a year regularly. I don't have students, so to speak, that come to me regularly.
Sure.
There's certain people that I listen once in a while.
Right.
Then I'm always open if somebody asks me, if I have physically the time. I will always try to listen to them because I had so many great people that took the time for me. So I always try to be available. But I think in the future, probably I will want to do more of that. I think maybe I will start traveling a little bit less at some point. Maybe I'll get enough of that and I'll settle down a little bit in Los Angeles. I love the weather, so I'll be at home a little bit more and maybe just teach a little bit more. But it is fascinating to be. I think I learn as I was teaching. I'm sure I would still learn a lot. But there's something really that gives you a lot of, in my case, I just have to ask myself so many questions when I'm teaching, because I think I had a lot of facilities when I was playing the piano. And very often, students will ask me how I do this or what, and I just don't understand what the problem is. I just want to say, well, you just do it.
Yet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of think now what, how, and why do I do this, and how do I do that? I think it makes you progress tremendously when you're teaching. You discover a lot of things. And there's nothing more rewarding than when you help somebody for an hour, and at the end of the hour, you see that you've made a difference, that the person actually is just not just plays better, but you actually help that person. They tell you, oh, that's great, I feel so much better, I can do that. Then you feel, wow.
When Ashkenazi gave you that fingering.
You feel like you really can help, and that's really is very rewarding. And I can see how it could be addictive. And I think it also is a mission, and I feel there is something, and now I'm thinking especially of the French tradition of Madame Descaves. I feel there's a real tradition that has to go on, and this I need to give as much as I can. All those things that I've learned from her, all those details on the music that a lot of people don't know and will never know, because at one point there won't be any more. Already now, there's, I think, very few people left in the world that knew Ravel.
Right.
There might be a few, but very little. They all died. So we have to go now to the next generation and pass it on to the future generation. So this is important, yes.
Well, passing it on to future generations, exciting all generations, and with a real consciousness of the best of generations that have come before him is, of course, Jean-Yves Thibaudet. He plays with one hand, but normally he plays very well with two. And we know, we really appreciate your sharing with us that experience of what it's like just physically to have to prepare for. I remember years ago talking with Leon Fleischer and a friend saying to him, I'm pretty sure I heard you play the Ravel in such and such a year in such and such a place. Well, in that time, as Fleischer said, if you heard the piece, you heard me playing it. And nowadays, of course, other two-handed pianists are picking it up. And
not too many, though.
Not too many.
Right. I think not too many people play it, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk
with
us and look forward to hearing the concerts. Music that you heard tonight, all by Jean-Yves Thibaudet, piano. First excerpts from the Concerto for the Left Hand of Maurice Ravel, the Orchestre Symphonique de Montréal, Charles Dutoit conducting, Page d'Albon of Claude Debussy, and then Thibaudet performing Jed Distler's transcription of Bill Evans's Waltz for Debbie. Thanks to Jean-Yves Thibaudet, the office of Mary Lou Falcone in New York, and the staff at Orchestra Hall for arranging our conversation with Jean-Yves Thibaudet. Thanks as well, as always, to Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great. Thanks too to Brandon Nicely for recording our interview. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and other friends of this program, and give our own welcome to our Community Insurance Consultants, Inc., for becoming the first ever commercial sponsors of Critical Thinking. We talk to you each week about how you can write to us at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, RENTAP, at AOL.com, and how you can visit us at WFMT.com/criticalthinking, where you can join the second 100,000 listeners to the Critical Thinking podcast. But we also want to let you know that Maximum Fun, a website that, among other things, reviews podcasts, has reviewed and reviewed favorably Critical Thinking this week. So check out Colin Marshall and Maximum Fun. We'll link to it at some point. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.